Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in...
Kia ora, everyone. Kia ora, Karen. Kia ora, Louisa. Today, Karen and I are talking about travel writing. We've brought along some favourite travel reads as well as some recent finds, which we think highlight the very different kinds of travel writing available today, as in available, you know, on your shelf in this day and age, not necessarily today. Anyway, from your classic travel story about a road trip or, in this day and age, an adventurous trip, to the creative non-fiction read where it is the writing that is more important than the travel itself, but Karen may beg to differ on that.
Well, I think they're equally important, I'd say, because the writing is inspired, after all, by the place.
I could see that look on your face.
Okay. For theater of the mind, of those who are not here with us.
Yeah. And then there is the pilgrimage travel story, which Karen is going to share more about later on.
So you are, I believe.
We both are, yes.
On the spot.
So Karen, let's get the journey underway. What is that interesting looking book you bought in today? It's got a big blue ship on the front cover.
That's a container ship with big red containers on it. So I've brought in for the recent find category. So we talked about we'd have recent finds and old favorites. So this is my recent find. So this is a book by Horatio Clare, an Anglo-Welsh writer, and it's called Down to the Sea in Ships. And it won, so I have always been meaning to read this book for years since I learned about how it had won the Stanford Dolman Travel Book of the Year Award, which is a very prestigious travel writing award, which is partly associated with Daunt Books, the greatest travel writing bookstore in the world in London. And I had to read about this when I used to report on these awards at Auckland Libraries. So I found it on the shelf, in fact, as you were saying, just recently, and I took it out. So it's a book about life on container ships on the high seas, which is a topic which was very appetizing to me. So I've sailed twice on large ships, not as large as a freighter or a container ship. These were oceanographic expedition ships, so sometimes refurbished tugs, sometimes a bit larger than that, in a working capacity, although I did get the job through knowing the chief scientist, who was my father.
I was wondering about that connection.
But anyway, unforgettable experiences. So I actually stood the watches and, you know, those watching the sunset come up at the end of your watch. And I was really pleased to find this book. Well, I've just read it in preparation for this show. I can't say I found it a book charged with vim and passion the way the Dolman Travel Book of the Year prize citation said, and which also said it was filled with polished and near poetic prose. So I'm going to say it was definitely filled, stuffed, I might say, but I didn't really feel the vim and the passion or the poetry. So Horatio offered himself as a writer in residence on the ships to start with. So he's not working on the ships, he's an observer. They don't just let anybody come and work on the ship, of course, on a cargo ship. And maybe that was the problem, because he's observing, but we never really get his personal observations or his learnings, his sort of inner journey. I couldn't really find the narrative. So the descriptions are very striking. There's, you know, the taking on the cargo in Hong Kong and taking off the cargo in China, I was going to say. The China full of manufactured goods. Yeah. And then other times the cargo is calf heads in brine, stinking up the whole ship. Or I think it's some kind of delectable frozen food that somebody has to climb up on the container twice a day and open a little hatch and check on the condition of the cargo. And lots of research and erudition if you're interested in practices of, you know, the great ships on the seas. So the terrifying practice of stoking the coal for the ship's engines, the luring 16-year-old boys to work on the ships. He's very woke, especially to the horrifying exploitation of seamen through history, including things like in World War One and lead up to World War One, the English government trying to set up a convoy system because of all the torpedoing by the German ships and the shippers and the speculators fighting the convoy system because they were making so much money off of the insurance for their lost cargoes. And then there's some interesting lore about seamen's superstition about, for instance, whistling on ships, or the tradition of the master's ticket and how the captain of the ship doesn't sign himself captain but master. And it was actually about the captain I had my first doubts, because he recounts how Graham, his friend on the ship, his, you know, the guy he's made friends with the crew, calls the captain the old man, as if this is like an invention of Graham. And actually, old man is what all of a ship's crew call the captain. So I knew that within a week of sailing. And I just got the feeling that maybe the crew didn't think as highly of him as he thought of himself. So there's the part where he meets the captain, and he says, the captain says, "So, Claire, is that your cabin?" And he says, "Horatio, captain." And the captain says, "We shall try to remember that." So anyway, then I
bit
got
of a mutiny guy. Was he sort of trying to spice things up with a bit of a mutiny against the captain, perhaps?
By telling the captain to call him Horatio.
Possibly. Observing these.
I'm not sure.
Traditions.
Maybe more when there's one scene where they catch him barefoot. I mean, you know, go and work on a working ship. Don't go barefoot on the ship. I just feel like that's waving a red flag in front of a bull. Anyway, so I got to the end, and I went and read the preface. And it turns out there's a little piece here about his motives for writing the book that just, I don't want to say appalled. I was stunned. So he says, his deeper motives for going only became clear to him when he returned. And this is what his motives were. "I was fascinated by the idea of men at sea. Shipping is still a man's world, quicker and more thoroughly than anywhere except perhaps a battlefield. The sea finds men out. I wanted to see men, their characters and their stories, as if on a bare stage, away from women, children, and the world. I was in love with the wonder, the romance, blah, blah, blah." So I thought, oh my God, like, when was this book written? I'm sure I remember winning the prize. Did I get it mixed up with a different book? Was this book written in the 60s or something? So I went and looked back, and it's from 2014. I just can't believe it was in 2014 somebody was presenting shipping as a man, you know, as a uniquely man's. There are women captains, shipping captains.
Well, that's what I was wondering.
Yes, there are, and I can share.
Do they call who the old woman?
No, they don't. They call them the old man, which I think is really, really cool. I think that's so cool. So so if you're interested in shipping, it's a great book. It's very informational. It's almost like a journalistic piece, but it's about the ship. It's not really about the journey. It's not a road trip story, so it doesn't have that narrative drive and that personal enrichment fertilization.
Yeah, he's not really experiencing what he's there to. He's just, like he says, he's observing and escaping, actually, isn't he? So he said he achieved what he set out to do, I guess. But can I talk about my book? My road trip book is a little bit different.
No, it's not my road trip book, because Down to the Sea and Ships, as much as I thought there was going to be a different kind of road trip book, it's actually not a road trip book.
Yes,
it's an exploration of ships. So you can do a road trip book.
I found a road trip book.
Yeah.
And it's different. And don't you love the way the library just presents you with these books, you know, that, you know, the unexpected, off the radar, enjoyable read just when you need it. I needed a road trip book and I found one, and it's really, really cool. So this is Skidoo, I hope I pronounced that correctly, by a Swiss-French author who writes in German. Okay, so we're getting
the picture. Got the German version there?
No, I've got the English version. I haven't quite mastered German, haha. So his name is Alex Kapus, and Skidoo is a journey through the ghost towns of the American Wild West.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, which is not what you would expect, I think. Well, I thought, from a Swiss-French author who writes in German to undertake this kind of journey or road trip. So anyway, we learn, so there's five stories. It's a very little book, as you can see. Five stories in it, and we learn from one of them. Skidoo is actually the name of one of the towns, ghost towns. And we learn poor old Hooch Simpson was lynched for robbing the bank and killing the bank manager. But it was discovered after the event that he was simply drunk and was trying to withdraw $20 of the $25,000, which must have been a lot of money back then, he had deposited with the bank. So another story that he tells us is his experience along Route 66, and now he's in modern day, and he's poking fun at the easy riders, giving the example of architects, accountants or plumbers from London, Düsseldorf, or Barcelona, who hire Harley Davidsons at great expense for, he says, pursuing their dreams of another existence along this highway.
Well, I've actually met two of those people. I met at the food town in Grey Lynn two Czechs who had gone on a Harley Davidson tour of Route 66, and I thought it was fantastic. I think this guy's a little bit snooty because that was their dream, Route 66, is what everyone grew up with. Get your kicks on Route 66.
Yeah, yeah.
He's there. He's on Route 66.
He's on Route. He doesn't say what vehicle he's in.
Oh, it's just because he's not
on
a Harley.
Observing how after miles and miles on the long straight road, he would observe how they were sort of like tenderly get off these powerful bikes after driving for miles, and could barely walk, and were very stiff, and so he was observing that they looked to him a little bit silly.
But they'd felt every bump of the road. You see, they'd been in for the 360-degree experience.
But the real story that he's telling us here is Route 66 was originally a camel track. So back in the old ghost town days, it was originally a camel track. And he even has gone to the depth of seeking out or researching evidence of this by telling us on the 2nd of March 1855, the US Congress approved $30,000 to introduce camels from North America to open up trade routes to the west. So that was the original Route 66. It then became a railway track, and now the road as we know it today.
So the highway.
The highway, yeah, the infamous highway. So there you go. So there's interesting side stories all the way through these stories. He's taken an enormous amount of time to research in detail these stories. I mean, they're just short stories. And he writes them because he is a novelist. I had to look him up because his works aren't familiar to me, but I will read one of his other travelogues, Sailing by Starlight, and this is In Search of Robert Louis Stevenson and Treasure Island.
Oh,
so that will be my next read by Alex Kappas, because I really enjoyed this book.
Yeah, no, that sounds really good. That's like what I thought Horatio Clare was going to be doing. So maybe you could pass it on to me afterwards. So, 23 Skidoo. Does he explain about what 23 Skidoo is?
No, he doesn't.
It's some phrase from like the 20s in America. I've never known what it meant. Maybe it had to do with taking out $23 from the bank. Anyway, I've brought, so speaking of the Wild West, so I was kind of wondering as you were speaking, because my next book is my old favorite. So you said old favorites and new finds. So my other the book I brought, which is an old favorite, is Bruce Chatwin's In Patagonia. And I was kind of wondering as you were talking about the Wild West, if Patagonia is sort of the Wild West of South America. I mean, you'd think it would be the Pampas and the Gauchos, but there's something just about the wildness of Patagonia and the fact that it's as far as you can go. Mm. So like a lot of people washed up in the Wild West.
Yes.
Yeah, me too. So this is a book from 40 years ago. I highly recommend it if you want to go to Patagonia. So I haven't been there yet, but someday maybe, one of my pilgrimages. It just has not aged at all. You can read this book, and it's just as original and new as when it first came out. It's got a mix of travel, history, adventure, odyssey. So he's got his odyssey is wanting to get to the bottom of the mystery surrounding a family heirloom, which is a piece of brontosaurus skin, which cousin Charlie, his grandmother's cousin Charlie, brought back from Patagonia.
Wow.
Yeah, and it starts with a much better preface than Horatio Clare's, with his motives about the great men, the valiant men. So it's actually not a preface at all. It's just a line from one of my favorite poets, Blaise Cendrars, about going to Patagonia. So Blaise Cendrars was also a merchant seaman, and his line is, there's nowhere left but Patagonia, Patagonia to match my huge sadness. And in a way, the Patagonia desert could be considered a bear stage, but instead of being attracted by that, or he's attracted by that, he writes about that, but he also wants to include the stories of the people he meets. And this is the part that
is so wonderful. Well, it's all wonderful. But he has these portraits of like the little German boy with the bust of Beethoven on his piano playing mazurkas while the wind whistles outside. The old English woman pouring him tea from a silver teapot and telling him about, there was a little shooting and by the afternoon they had all the Marxists rounded up. It was beautifully done. And then the maestro, who's a poet, who's a teacher of literature from Buenos Aires, who'd arrived 40 years before and stayed. This is also very Wild West. Living alone, well, not quite alone. He's got a colony of pet toads in a two-room hut. I think the toads are outside of the hut. And he's got this desk littered with broken almond shells and his favorite books, which sounds just like my table at home, except that I buy my almonds already shelled. So anyway, he's got this thing where he cries out, the poet, when he's talking with the poet, he says, the poet cries out, Patagonia, she is a hard mistress. She casts her spell, an enchantress. She folds you in her arms and never lets go. The rain drummed on the tin roof. For the next 2 hours, he was my Patagonia. So this is the book. It's just evocative. I love that word, evocative.
Yes.
I want to get rid of captivating.
I can see you've already transplanted yourself there in Patagonia. Karen.
That's right. So the 2 hours that you read the book, is for the 2 hours, Bruce Chatwin was my Patagonia. And it just is, I just love in travel writing the evoking of a place. So, you know, there's a Roman, ancient Roman term, the genius loci, which is the spirit, the actual spirit in the sense of like a little, you know, person, a non-living person, a spirit, a ghost, a saint, if you will, but the Romans, pre-saint time. Yeah, exactly. So the one that guarded the place, the protective spirit of a place. And in contemporary usage, we say genius loci to refer to that distinctive atmosphere of a place, which we also, interestingly, call the spirit of the place. But don't we? But we don't mean the spirit. We're not seeing a little person.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. So that's my thing about the evoking of a place. And then, of course, the reason for writing the book is just really an excuse in a way. So the brontosaurus skin, he might have gone to Patagonia even without the brontosaurus skin.
Well, true. So it could have just been a place he really wanted to visit.
Yeah, and, the end of the earth.
It's like, reason to visit. So, funny we should mention that, because reasons for traveling. My next travel writing book is actually Lonely Planets Better Than Fiction, which they've brought out quite a few editions where they invite writers to contribute a story about their own travel experiences. So in the 2015, I think, edition, there is a story from New Zealand's own, the 2019 Ockham Book Award winner, Fiona Kidman, and she's contributed a very honest, I think it's very honest, telling of a nearly disastrous trip to Vietnam, which the reason for being for this trip was inspired by a book, surprise, surprise, The Quiet American, written by Graham Greene. Is that one familiar to you, Karen?
Yeah, it wasn't to me. I've read that. I'm a huge Graham Greene fan. He should have won the Nobel Prize, but they kept it from him for political reasons. He was too anti-American. But yeah, The Quiet American is a CIA agent, and it's set in the period just before the Americans took over the war in Vietnam, so it's still kind of French, decaying French colonial Saigon. It's a wonderful book.
Right. So, well, yes, Fiona thought so.
So Fiona
too.
Did well to be inspired to go to Vietnam from that book.
And
I'm sure she found anything that responded to the decaying pre-Vietnam War Saigon, but
yeah, she'll visited tell us. In the 1990s, I think it was. So it wasn't the tourist mecca that it is now. So I'm going to read a piece. The Road to Lost Places is its title. So she starts off, some of my most memorable adventures have begun so benignly with the seemingly harmless preoccupations of a writer at her desk. All my life I've been interested in the places where writers lived and the journeys they took. Not those of my contemporaries, which seems intrusive, but rather those seen from the distance of a life in its entirety. I've been especially drawn to the dark moral dilemmas that stalk through the work of Graham Greene, The Quiet American, set in Vietnam, is one of my favourites among his books. So there you go, Fiona and you have something in common. I knew that for a time he had forsaken Roman Catholicism embraced the Cao-Deist religion, a unique sect founded in 1926 and based in South Vietnam. And that, its temple, the Tay Nin province, had provided one of the prime settings for the novel. In 1991, there we go, we have the year she visited, I innocently decided that I would go there. And then she goes on with her story.
Yeah.
That her and her husband got up to a bit of trouble while they were there.
Oh,
but they decided
mischief.
To take a... bit of an adventure they didn't plan on encountering. They asked their driver to take them. They, when you're traveling, that spontaneous, let's go there, and off the driver goes. But it was not a safe route to take. So, it was an experience that she will never forget. And if you want to know more about it, read the story, read the book.
Yeah, well, the story is exactly fits into that category that you mentioned in your opening lines about the pilgrimage travel story. So the pilgrimage of going to the place where one of your favorite books, which inspired one of your favorite books. For instance, Luisa, thinking of you and your goal of reading Don Quixote, of which you are at least halfway through by now. Have you been to see the windmills that Don Quixote fought against in, where is it, Capo da Criptana?
Ah, well, you've caught me out there, Karen.
No, I know you've been to Spain a number of times. It's on your list.
I haven't finished reading the book, and no, I haven't been to visit the windmill. So I do intend to undertake my literary pilgrimage.
To follow Don Quixote.
To go back to Spain.
Yeah, exactly. If anyone needed an excuse.
But can we veer off the literary pilgrimage then and talk about an art pilgrimage? Because I did do a South of France one in my youth, visiting the fields and villages painted by Picasso and Van Gogh, as many of us have done.
You do yourself not enough credit. I'm not sure many of us have done that. That sounds like a wonderful pilgrimage. Put your head up high and say
that. Well, yeah, but so many writers have. If you read, you know, they've all been to Antibes, and Arles, and I thought they were quite adventurous things for me to do. But no, so many others have done it, and because I've got these two beautiful, stunning books here about the New Zealand painter Francis Hodgkins. They're rather large. Do you want to grab one, Karen? they're timed to mark the 150th anniversary of Francis's birth in Dunedin. And there's also an exhibition at the Auckland Art Gallery, that's the one, Tamaki. So one of the books came about because in order to complete the catalogue of her works ready for the exhibition, Mary Kiesler, senior curator at the gallery, embarked on a pilgrimage to accurately place and date her paintings. So luckily for Mary, I'm so jealous of this, Hodgkins was an intrepid Kiwi girl who, like so many artists of the early 20th century, sought the freedom and creative inspiration, these are my words, in the Mediterranean. So in 2015...
And warm weather,
yes, escaping the English weather or something like that. So in 2015, Mary set off for England, Wales, France, Spain, Italy, and Morocco, like Hodgkins had done in 1901, to match paintings to locations.
Wow.
What a trip.
Right, yeah.
So Finding Francis Hodgkins is the book that Mary's written, telling the two stories, the two travel stories. So her story combined with Hodgkins' own journey. So I'm a fan of Francis Hodgkins' art. I'm no art critic, but or expert. But I do like that feminine touch in her works, the colours, the watercolours, the colour palette, and you still see that influence of the post-impressionists that influenced her work in there. But yeah, it's her own work, and they're really beautiful. So both books have stunning images of her works, and I'm enjoying.
So did we say the name of the second book?
The second book.
Because it's Mary Kiesler again.
Yes.
It's edited by Catherine Hammond and Mary Kiesler, both from the Art Gallery.
Yeah, so this is...
the European Juniors.
Yeah, so this is, comes out of the art exhibition European Journeys. I think the exhibition is titled European Journeys. And again, it's more your coffee book, coffee table type.
Possibly
book.
Both. Possibly coffee table and coffee.
Just don't having spill coffee. The coffee on the beautiful images. Whereas Finding Frances Hodgkins is your travel.
Yeah.
Story.
Pilgrimage story. Pilgrimage and personal story, journey. Yeah. Oh, good for Mary Kisser. She's fantastic. Yeah. So literary pilgrimages. So back to.
Oh, yes. I was going. I should have asked you about your.
Well, you didn't have to ask
literary
because I would tell you anyway.
I know there'd be one up your sleeve.
Well, I actually have a dream literary pilgrimage, which I haven't taken yet, which is St. Petersburg.
Oh.
I've done many literary pilgrimage, as you guest. So I've been to see, you know, Kafka's grave in Prague in the Jewish cemetery. And I've been to, I went to the Lake Country to see the boat from, I was in the Lake Country, but I went specifically to the town where they had the boat from Swallows and Amazons, the children's books, which were such a great read from my childhood. But the boat was being cleaned and we only got to see John Ruskin's umbrella. That was the high point. It was a very small museum. Without the boat, there wasn't much left. But my dream literary pilgrimage is actually to St. Petersburg, as I was saying, where Russian literature, which is such a big part of my life, let's put it that, my life, was born, and where so many of the greats of Russian literature lived, so Dostoevsky above all, perhaps. So you can go to St. Petersburg, and you can see the Haymarket, where Raskolnikov from Crime and Punishment wandered, and the barracks, where Dostoevsky himself was made to undergo a mock execution. I don't know if you know about this, but for anti-Tsar activity. Yeah, he was actually, with other prisoners, brought out into the barracks courtyard, blindfolded, and the order given to shoot, and then they said, oh no, actually, no, we're not going to execute you, and took them back to their cells, which is, well, you know, probably left a mark on his life, I think we can say.
Traumatic.
And you can see his grave, and you can see the Dostoevsky Memorial Apartment, which is the apartment where he wrote The Brothers Karamazov, and where he died, which is full of manuscripts, letters, and memorabilia.
So do
keyword.
Did they have one of those tours then when you get there? Literary
like a Dostoevsky walking tour.
Yes.
Well, I'm sure they do. So you could look that up in this with our final book, which is so great.
Oh, really. My gosh. She is holding a book.
Novel Destinations.
It is littered with posters.
Well, it's so just to give an idea of flavor in our final minutes here. So this book, this wonderful book with a great pun title, Novel Destinations, is a travel guide to literary landmarks from Jane Austen's Bath to Ernest Hemingway's Key West. I think they could have made a better joke. They could have fit together two places that set each other off more. It could have been Jane Austen's Bath and Hemingway's Bay or something like that. Hemingway's daiquiris. Anyway, so for instance, I learned in this book, I'll just give you a flavor here, Louisa.
Yeah.
So you can go to see in America Louisa May Alcott's house, where you can see where there's the parlor couch where Jo March, the eldest of the girls in Little Women, in the book it tells you about how she had this sausage-shaped pillow that was her mood indicator. So if the pillow was standing on end, you could come and chat with her. But if it was on its side, it meant do not disturb. And you can go to Orchard House and you can buy a replica mood pillow in the gift shop.
Oh, wow. I actually don't remember that part in the book, but it's very cool. I love the way they picked it up.
She also says in the book, there's a lot of descriptions of her eating apples while she reads, but I remember a replica apple.
Yeah, it's a bit harder.
And in Baltimore, you can go see the Edgar Allan Poe house, where you can see the engraved walking stick that the writer accidentally left behind in Richmond in the days prior to his mysterious death. And then you've got the Jane Austen Festival in Bath, where you don't have to dress up like a Regency costume. And you can go to Paris, and it's got the list of all the Parisian cafes of the literati, so you can pick, they had the rich people, the poor people, the left-wingers, the existentialists, and so on, and explains them all to you. You can go to the Ritz, where apparently it claims its most loyal patron was Marcel Proust. Who knew that? We all knew about Hemingway, who became known, according to this book, as the Proust of the Ritz. So if you want to become known as Louisa of the Ritz.
That should have been the tagline for the book.
Yeah, it could have been. You mean along with Ernest Hemingway's Key West and Marcel Proust's Ritz. So anyway, Louisa, if you want to be a, if you want to become Louisa of the Ritz, that's where you can get this book out. And that's really unfortunate.
I think we should do our own pilgrimage and write our own novel destinations book. That's part two.
Oh, well, we can do it online. We can. This is certainly a good inspiration. So thank you all for being with us.
Thank you.
And kakiteano.
Kakiteano.
This program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz
and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond. Every day, every day, every day, every day.